Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, music from the Coasters in conversation with the last surviving original member, Leon Hughes. Emmanuel Rogers speaks with Dan Kanan, author of Polar, a Particular Book, a fascinating picture book using some creative imaging techniques. We're going to start in conversation with Tori Cook, curator of an exhibit not only in a gallery, but encompassing outdoor murals as well. That's Women of the New Contemporary at the Brandstetter Gallery at La Sierra University, running through April 7th. I'd like to start, if we could, by talking about what the new contemporary as a movement is. Can you really break it down for the layperson? Let's approach it this way. You know, any movement in art has always been a reaction to something else. So then this, the new contemporary.
I think new contemporary really encompasses a style of art that maybe speaks to a wider section of a population, meaning it doesn't talk down to people. It's easily relatable. It's a big cross-section of different mediums. Galleries that usually showcase new contemporary have a variety of price points, so collectors can start young and move up from there. People can feel very comfortable coming into galleries and interacting with the artists and being a part of this type and style of art. So I think when we talk about new contemporary, that can cover all sorts of different mediums, from street art to lowbrow, pop surrealism, all sorts of different styles, but it's accessible.
It's in essence getting away from what often we feel like when we walk into an art gallery, sometimes we worry that we should have learned about this in art history class or whatever, and this new contemporary really gets away from that.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the exhibit itself, Women of the New Contemporary. This is an exhibit of works by 31 female artists, including several murals, and this is currently running at La Sierra University's Brandstetter Gallery. Isn't there talk of extending the dates for the gallery showing currently?
Yes. So the show is going to be extended all the way through Thursday, April 7th, so more people can get a chance to see the work. And I've also been talking with Tim about doing some panels with a few of the local artists. And that will be announced as soon as we have those dates confirmed.
Wonderful. Now, we'll get some closer looks in just a bit. For now, broadly speaking, what kind of an exhibit is this? Mostly paintings, but some other media as well. I know some photographic work, some sculpture.
I wanted to curate a show that showcased a variety of styles. So we have two photographers. We have two artists that have contributed sculptures to the show. That's Camilla Taylor and Laurie Fold. The rest of the artists have a variety of mediums in painting and some paper collage as well. Since we were bringing something new to La Sierra University in the Riverside, I wanted to bring in a wide variety of different styles of art that might speak to different students or different visitors to the gallery, to the show. This will be running through the 7th of April.
All right. And you're a gallery owner as well. Can we hear a little bit about that? And you're an artist yourself?
I am a self-taught artist. I've always been inspired and excited by art since I was a baby, but I did not go to school for art. I have been a gallery owner for the past almost 6 years, and before that I was doing pop-up art shows that would travel across the country and some internationally. Opening the gallery seemed like a natural step from doing art shows that were not permanent. It just seemed like a natural progression to want to have a set of walls and a set of lights that never change, and then we can bring artists into that environment in a more traditional manner to help support them in their careers. That's why I went in that direction with opening the gallery.
And gave you a permanent mailing address, too.
Yes, and I mean, there are benefits to doing both. I mean, when you have a gallery, it comes with a whole new set of challenges and responsibilities, and it brings you into like a different segment of the art world. I grew up in Southern California, so a lot of my art influences, and granted, I've traveled all over the world, been to museums all over the world, but the art that was exciting me was art that I would see through what younger people were creating. And I guess that would be, you know, the artists that started putting their art on skateboards in the 80s and on snowboards in the 90s and on street art. And that was kind of the style that got me excited and then really inspired me to want to create. So that's kind of my niche, and the artists that I support are artists that I still feel excited about and that I have been excited about over the past 20 years. So these artists aren't necessarily young or new, but they have used different avenues to get their work out there and influence young people. And that's pretty exciting. It's just different. And we all come together to create these kind of pieces of the art world puzzle. And there's so many different layers to that. And that's kind of one thing that's really fun about doing this Women of New Contemporary show. I'm bringing some of the artists that are showing in smaller galleries to a university level and exposing both sides to different realms.
And, you know, in this skateboard art and the snowboard art, that's a great example of some of the new contemporary, because it's not like you could, under normal circumstances, go to a museum unless it was something wacky in the LACMA or something like that that would have some of this kind of art on it.
Basically, so I was saying about the new contemporary movement, these artists are finding different vehicles to get their art out there and then be able to influence a wider cross-section of our population. And I think that's so important because my philosophy has always been that art creates community. Art creates a way for people to communicate with each other on a different level, on an easier level, on something that kind of breaks down barriers. And granted, we all have art that we like and we don't like. So in a sense, we are still judging because
sure.
We don't like everything.
Oh, sure.
But at the same time, you can, as an artist, be able to communicate a part of yourself and get a piece of yourself out there on a very basic level without having to necessarily be face-to-face with someone who might be judging. I'm going on a tangent a little bit here because I feel, you know, on a basic level with art being in school, not just university level, but in an elementary level, you know, you see how humans, when they react, when they're creating art and around it, it's just so much more warm and inviting than sometimes other parts of our lives. And I feel like it is so important to be able to kind of have this area that we can have in our lives, not necessarily an escape from some of the heavier parts of our lives that we have, but maybe,
yeah.
You know.
Maybe it is. Yeah.
Maybe it is a way to forget about that kind of stuff and just paint on a wall sometimes.
Yeah, dull those edges or at least round off the corners or something. Staring at a blank piece of paper is just as good as completing a piece, I have to say sometimes. But
yeah.
So Women of the New Contemporary, you have artists from all over the U.S., about half from Southern California, but also England and the Netherlands. How did you end up getting artists from such vastly different areas?
I have to say about half of the artists I had already worked with before in some capacity. But one thing that I feel like has changed art dramatically has been the invention and use of Instagram, which is really interesting to me. It's become this vehicle. Artists can put out their work so easily, and then by following these little threads and hashtags and different galleries that are out there, you can find artists that are all over the world and pretty quickly get a feel if you like their style or not. And then the more you kind of follow them, it allows you to get a feel for different artists. And whether that's a good thing or not a good thing, I don't know, that's a whole other debate. But I find it very interesting that this world today is becoming so much smaller as far as for artists to get their work out there. Artists that I've worked with for a long time and then artists that I meet through those connections, or galleries that I have followed that I respect and I love their style, so I obviously follow their artists. And then also just these people that kind of come into my world through poking around on the internet or poking around through Instagram, you know? It's like a nebulous group. So I think to answer the question about how I gathered this particular group, it's been artists that I have followed for quite a while. Some I have worked with, some I've wanted to work with, and bring them all together. Obviously, it's nice to have artists that are close by for the show so that they can come to the opening and be present, because it's not, with a budget, it's hard to fly in a lot of artists internationally into Riverside. But I think we had a really great balance of artists that actually even knew of each other or know of each, maybe they've never met before, but they have followed each other's work, because every single artist that's been a part of Women of the New Contemporary has been so grateful. I'm so excited to be part of this great group of artists. They know each other. And you know, that's a whole other thing on how the internet has affected the art world, and I'm sure everyone that's in their part of the art world has a different viewpoint on it, whether it's good or bad.
Sure.
But you can't deny that it's changed, well, the whole world, I guess.
The World Wide Web.
Yeah, but I definitely think it has changed the way galleries function, that's for sure. I mean, not that I have been a gallery owner for a long time, but I mean, I feel like even in the past 6 years, like when I first opened my gallery, there was no Instagram. I could see firsthand how quickly things can change. I mean, that's another interesting thing, maybe, that when you start thinking about how fast the world is changing and then artists reacting to that in their work, too. It's pretty neat.
I wonder if Al Gore had any concept that this would, what his internet would do.
You'll have to ask him, definitely.
Oh, I promise you. These murals, particularly one that had a rabbit as part of them, is this by chance an artist that has a show running at your gallery right now as well?
Yes, Dahlia De Luis. She's from the Bay Area. She did paint one of the murals at La Sierra University, and we do have a solo show with her at Artist Republic in Laguna Beach right now. I have worked with her for quite a few years on different projects, but this is her first solo show that she's had with us, and also her first individual large-scale mural at La Sierra University. So mm-hmm. It's pretty exciting. I think it's been a great experience for all of the artists involved in the show, and then especially the artists that came out to work on the murals and work on the buildings. It's just been a really special and unique time. I feel like most of that has to do with the fact that La Sierra University is such a beautiful campus, such warm and inviting faculty. Tim Musso, who is the gallery director, is just amazing. I mean, it's his students that are in the art department just love him and are so excited to be there. And it's such a great facility. And that energy just naturally kind of fell down onto the shoulders of everyone who has visited, and especially the artists that got to work there for multiple days on these walls. And so I think that's why, you know, most of the artists, they might have had a general idea of what they were planning on painting beforehand, but most of them changed or at least tweaked their designs once they were on campus and got to feel the environment and see the natural beauty around and interact with the students. And so I think that's a main reason why these murals just really fit the area and the campus so well, even though they're vastly different from each other as far as concept.
No, I actually remember reading, I think that was a statement from Velia, that she had a general idea that it would be flora and fauna, but she had to wait for the specifics until she got there and really felt the space. And that's something it was really cool and something I could relate to and respect. And one more thing about the murals, by the way, was the concept of murals being a part of this, was that concept there from the beginning, or was it something that you found maybe once you realized the access you had to muralists? Chicken or egg?
I think it was both. After having worked on a few different murals over the past year in different locations, I definitely knew how exciting it is to be able to watch a mural get painted. And so I really felt like that would be a great addition for the show, not only for the students there, but for visitors and people that live in the area that maybe don't get to see murals in a closer proximity. So, yeah, from the beginning, it was something I wanted to do. But then Tim really had to convince the right people at the school that it was a good idea. And he has been such a great part of that campus over the past, I think he's been there 6 years. So they really trust him. And so because of that, he was able to get the approval to really have free rein to do whatever the artist wanted to do, which is pretty incredible, I feel like, especially for a smaller private school to take that risk. Just a testament to the fact that he's done such a great job with what he does in the past. You know, so I wanted to step up and bring some artists that I felt would be really perfect for the school. So I did several trips out there to talk with Tim about the show and walk the arts complex and meet the students and really be able to pick the artists that I thought would be a good fit for the campus.
That's a wonderful testament, too, as well. So I'm glad we got that in there. A couple of parts of the exhibit that I'd love a bit of elaboration on. It's described as speech bubbles.
Okay, Martha Rich, she's the artist that did the speech bubbles or the talk bubbles. Martha's from Philadelphia, and we flew her out specifically to work on the mural, and then she has an installation of cut-out wood talk bubbles. They're all different colors. She's cut out some faces, too. So these kind of speech bubbles, like you would see maybe in a Sunday cartoon, right, when mm-hmm. a person talks and they have the little bubble.
Sure.
And then within those, she just writes little phrases that maybe she catches over, you know, here in conversation when she's standing in line for coffee, or funny little snippets of words, and she'll write little things on each bubble and then use maybe 50 to 100 bubbles to make this installation. So on the exterior of one of the buildings, she also painted these bubbles and then would fill them in with little sayings that she heard from students in the time she was out there. And I think it was 4 days that Martha was in Riverside. She stayed on campus and really created a lot of connections with the students there. And so people that come out to visit the murals, you can't miss it. You know, she's got this vibrant wall of all these talk bubbles and faces and stuff. It's really neat.
Can you tell me a bit about what she said? This is a photographic portion.
What we're talking about is an installation of photographs from Deanna Templeton. She grew up in Southern California and still lives in Huntington Beach. She and her husband travel all over the world. They both are very well-known artists. She has a book that's going to be coming out this year as well. And she has been working on this project where she has shot young women all over the world. You know, she grew up in this Southern California kind of like rebellious punk rock scene. And so the women that she shoots, even though they're modern and contemporary, they kind of fit that vein of women that she can see herself in them. And then she partners the photographs with excerpts from her actual journals from when she was younger, like mid-80s. Pretty interesting combination, and I feel like women from all ages can kind of connect. For myself, I graduated high school in the early 90s, so during that time of growth and finding yourself, I get like growing up, you know, I really relate to stuff that she talks about because I was that same age that Deanna was. But then you have people like my mom who came to see the show, and she's in her 70s, and she really reacted to the installation because it kind of gave her an insight to maybe what I had been going through or what younger people had been going through, because you have this snippet from a journal that's looking directly into someone's private mind and thoughts. And then younger women would be like, I'm not alone in this. Okay, you know, other people might feel the same way, or this might have happened to someone else too. So anyway, I feel like her installation of photographs, it's very different from the rest of the show, and it's a little bit more poignant, but it's such a great piece as part of Women of the New Contemporary.
I have to say that's really cool conceptually, too. So these are pictures of girls who remind the artist of her own teen experiences, but the quotes that are there are her own quotes. It's coupled together. Oh, wow, nice. We've spoken a bit about the murals, the speech bubbles, also what she said. I know there's some sculpture as well, but what I'd really like to know, before we wrap this up, I'd really like to know what else really struck you, like whether it was the first thing that you knew you had to have in the exhibit, or maybe it was something that you had access to later and said, oh my God, now I've got to make room for this as well.
That's really tough. I can't answer that question, but I was really, really excited about being able to invite a large section of artists that I hadn't yet gotten to work with and had wanted to for a really long time. And even with the artists that I have worked with for years, I still get excited about inviting them to do new stuff and having them push themselves and to see what they're going to do.
Absolutely.
It's like Christmas morning, you know, getting to do these things and seeing what happens.
Nice.
They're all exciting. I mean, I can't say there's just been one that I was overly excited about.
Sure. Well, that's cool.
The murals I was really excited to do because I just know how fun it is. I've been able to kind of assist on different mural projects. Just being able to see the excitement of such a different, like I keep saying, a different cross section from young kids to business owners to artists. There's so many different types of people from vastly different backgrounds that when they get to see an artist painting and they get to talk with them a little bit and they get to feel a part of what's going on, and then that mural lives on a wall that's in their neighborhood and they got to talk to the artist. So now they have a little bit of feeling of ownership over that, like they're a part of it. It's just this kind of magical moment that you just don't always get in life. And so I think that's why I was very excited to be able to bring a few artists to do murals. And when we had the opening, we had the last section of women, they were all local women, actually painting during the opening. They were up on scaffolding and Tim had them lit up. It's a wonderful feeling. You know, if there are business owners out there that have wall space, maybe they would like to have artwork, consider allowing artists to do that. It's not just graffiti. It's not just tagging. And sometimes even murals can combat that because hopefully people won't tag over that. But to have and live with art is important. And to be able to live with art where you don't even have to go into the gallery to live with it, you can kind of walk by it and see it on a daily basis. It's really cool.
Beautiful.
I mean, we walk by advertising all day, every day, and that's all we see.
Nice break from that.
Yeah.
We'll have information on La Sierra University and contact the Brandstetter Gallery and more in just a bit. But while we've got you on the phone, to get more on Artists Republic Gallery.
People can get information online at artist-republic.com. Our Instagram is artist_republic.
Are you on Facebook?
We are on Facebook, Artists Republic Gallery.
Okay, well, that's easy enough. Social media has been great for artists.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like, no, granted, like I said, I'm still pretty young as far as a gallery owner. 6 years is not a long time.
Sure.
But I definitely can see where before social media, artists would have to get your portfolio together. You take your physical work down to the gallery, you show it to them, and you kind of hope to make a connection and that they'll start representing you. Like, that was the way.
Yeah, get slides made.
And now, you don't have to do that at all. You can just start to post your stuff, Facebook, Instagram. You can share your work and yourself in that manner, and it has opened up so many doors, I think. These are interesting tools, and I don't know what's going to happen next, but things change fast.
True. Okay. I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to seeing not only this gallery installation, but I hope to be able to make it down to Laguna and check out your stuff there as well.
Thank you so much for taking the time to support something like this, because it means a lot to quite a few of us.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
So to be able to kind of spread the word and let people know about it is so important.
That's Tori Cook, Artists Republic Gallery in Laguna Beach and curator of Women of the New Contemporary at the Brandstetter Gallery at La Sierra University running through April 7th. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Later in the program, music from the Coasters in conversation with original member Leon Hughes. It's part of an all-star lineup coming to Ontario soon. Right now, though, it's a picture book with some old technology used in some new ways. And yes, as this is radio, as we listen, you can check out a bit of what we're hearing about at workman.com, also motionviewers.com. It's Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Dan Kanin, author of Polar, a Feticular Book.
Thank you for joining us today, Dan.
Good to be here.
Well, Dan, I'm looking at your book, and it's a wonderful 3D rendition, man, for polar regions and animals and life that's there. Why did you write this book? Why did you create it?
Well, the two books before it, Safari and then Ocean after that, okay. One of the big motivations is really being able to offer something that people just can't see anywhere else. Not everyone's been on a safari. Not everyone can get in a submersible and go thousands of feet down in the ocean. Not everybody can go out into the North Pole or the South Pole. In fact, I have not been those places either because I use licensed film clips for these things since people like the BBC, Wildlife Unit, and National Geographic, they have the best photographers in the world. They have the best equipment. They go to any lengths to get these shots. They can camp out for a whole month just to get a really great shot. I'm dedicated, but maybe not that dedicated. So I've taken footage that they have, which is stunning, and tried to find the most dramatic, best suited pieces to this medium of foticular. And then I take a portion in the film clip. So what you're really looking at is a very short film clip. I will take so many frames from the clip, then translate it so that it works for this medium. The thrill in the book is really to be able to just take people places that they couldn't go.
Now, you actually hold some patents for creating the process for doing this. I don't know how much I can ask on how do you actually put these pictures together in this book to make it work so well.
It's no secret. The process of foticular, also called lenticular, also called integrated imaging, has been around in many different forms. The basic idea is to take two or more images, cut them into slices, interleave the slices, and then have some sort of screen in front of them so that you only see like every other one, every third one at a time. And that way you can show a whole image. If you use a lens, the whole lens is filled by that particular image. Sort of like walking by a fence. If you're in one position between the pickets, you'll see one image, and in another position, you see something else. So that's the basic principle. It's been around a long time. It was first done practically, I guess, especially with plastic lenses in the 1950s, okay. When you had the little Cracker Jacks boxes and those sort of things.
Yeah, I remember the buttons and baseball cards and all. But this is really wonderful, and I thank you for that description for our audience, because I'm really hoping they'll be able to take looks at the book and some of the other books, Ocean and Safari also, while we're talking. Now, with that, will you describe some of the animal pictures in Polar for our listeners, and also maybe the aurora?
Well, I'll start with the aurora because we were thrilled to find this shot. It's a hard thing to show in this medium, and this shot really lends itself to it. It was taken in a little village, Sami, which is an indigenous tribe in Lapland, and it's really a very stunning time-lapse of the aurora borealis. One of my other favorite pictures from the book is the sled dogs, aside from the cover shot of the penguins, which are like, you know, penguins are just like, who wouldn't like a penguin? It's like a big plush toy.
Yeah.
But the sled dogs is pretty dramatic because, in the first place, the faces of these Siberian huskies are really just beautiful with those ice blue eyes. They just have such beautiful faces. And the shot is taken from right in front. There must have been a sled in front of them as they're running along right at you.
Yeah.
And it's taken from a low vantage point. So it's a very unusual shot. It's really a great shot. I like this snowy owl a lot, too, because they're really beautiful animals.
When you were talking about the dogs and the shot, as far as taking from the perspective of looking up at the dogs instead of straight on, that is a wonderful shot because you're getting the intensity as if the dogs are really the ones that are thinking and doing in this shot, not so much the driver there.
Right, exactly. Exactly, yeah. The dogs, they know what they're doing. I had a friend as a kid. Their family just loved huskies, and they had a few of them. And when the winter came along, this was down in Washington, D.C., you know, it would snow in the winter, and the huskies just loved it. They'd go out and, like, curl up and sleep together in the snow. They're bred for it, and they love it.
Yeah, you know, when I first opened Polar and looked at it, I thought, well, something's wrong with my eyes, because it looked like the penguin moved. But from the moment I saw it move, I have just been entranced with this book, like a kid that's gotten one of his first 3D buttons. This is Emmanuel Rogers speaking with Dan Kanan, who talks about his new, literally moving book, Polar, a Foticular Book. This is really spectacular to me. But you also mention in your book about the beauty and the inspiration of the polar regions. What is the beauty? And what is the inspiration about the polar regions for you?
Well, it's because they're so different, remote and severe. They're severe in a way that even a desert isn't. You can go out on a desert and, okay, you'll die of thirst at the end of the day, maybe, because you really, like, the water goes right out of you on a desert if you've ever been on one. But in the poles, I mean, you can freeze to death in minutes. You just can't be there at certain times unless you're really, really prepared. One of the things I mentioned in my introduction is Jack London's story, fantastic short story, To Build a Fire.
Yes.
Where this guy is out in 75 below. When he spits, his spit crackles in the air. Doesn't even have to hit the ground. So he's out there with a dog, and he has to build a fire in order to stay alive. But his hands are kind of frozen. So, you know, it's a real challenge, and it's a fascinating story. And it really gives you the feeling of being there. He also writes it in this very sort of impersonal way, as if to show how impersonal nature is.
And I also noticed, besides the beauty and inspiration that you're describing, the beauty of the animals, the beauty of the aurora that's showing in this book, that they can also look at on motionviewers.com. There are also things you talked about as far as challenges and destruction of these regions. Can you tell us a little bit about the challenges and where does the destruction come from?
Well, I mean, I don't want to sound flippant, but the pun is intended when I say we're skating on thin ice when it comes to the environment. And it's funny that the poles are very, very cold, although they are warming at a faster rate than anywhere else on the planet. If you look at these maps from NASA, etc., you'll see that the extreme regions are warming, and this will make sea level rise, and that won't be good for places like Florida and New York.
Right.
And the California coast would do better because it's a sharper coast. It's much higher up. The Atlantic coast is very gradual. So I think it's something like every level, 1 foot of sea level rise eliminates about 1,000 feet of coastline
Wow.
on the Atlantic coast because it's a gradual slope. because of the landforms. So the environment is in a very precarious position now, and that means we are too. So I'm very interested in raising awareness. You know, the jungles, the oceans, and the poles, if we don't do something soon, and it might even be sort of too late to get out of it unscathed, but we really got to pay attention.
So we really have the potential for not only losing the polar regions as they are today, but many of the species that live there.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure you've seen films of these polar bears. They get stranded on the ice.
Yes.
It's eliminating their habitat and many other animals. You can't change an ecosystem like that and expect nothing to happen. And if the animals go, that's not a good sign.
Right.
People think that we're just so different, but we're animals too. So it's a very serious subject.
I'm not sure if most listeners are like myself, but when I see pictures like that of the polar bear on that little piece of ice, I think, well, he can swim. He can find more ice over there. But there's coming a point where he won't be able to find more ice.
That's part of what's going on, and he can't find his normal prey either. So he has to eat usually seals, fish, and if he's off the mainland, he won't be able to do that. You know, I'm not expert enough to say specifically what the situation is, but in general, you don't have to be a scientist to see that it's eliminating their habitat.
Right.
It's restricting it so much that they won't be able to survive.
Right. Now, Dan, you also mentioned two other books, Safari and Ocean, which our listeners can also go to workman.com to check out. Will you tell us a little bit about Safari and Ocean?
Well, Safari was the first one, and that was really the biggest challenge because we hadn't done it yet. And now we've got, you know, kind of a whole floor of a factory over there in China putting these books out. But it was a real challenge to come up with techniques that enabled the accuracy of alignment in a paper book where the image and the screen, you know, the screen has these parallel lines in it, the lenses. They're a 1/30 of an inch thick, and they're maybe 6 inches wide, this sheet of lenses. And underneath the image, if you looked at it by itself, you'd also see these lines.
Right.
They need to be parallel to that screen to within really 1/1000th of an inch. And so how do you do that with paper that expands and contracts and, you know, it's paper? It took a lot of clever thought to figure out how to keep things aligned so that expansion didn't bother it, et cetera, et cetera. It was really quite a challenge. We thought we'd do it in a year with Safari, and for a while it looked like it really wouldn't happen. I was incredibly worried, and the production guy that went with me there, when the first samples started coming back, were put out for sale, we just thought, oh, you know, people are going to send them back. They're not going to work. So I thought, I'll believe it when I get the first royalty check. And even when I did, I still didn't quite believe it. I might still be in slight disbelief because it was just such a saga to do. It took a couple of years to get that right. Then after that, it's been, you know, not such a terrible challenge, but things come up. You know, we have to keep after it. So it was technically very difficult. The first viewer that I made that you can see on motionviewers.com, that's an injection molded piece. The images that you slide into it, about the size of a postcard, are interchangeable.
Ah.
And it works every time because it's injection molded, and so it's very, very accurate. But in order to do it with a book that's made mostly of paper, except for that plastic screen that's glued in there, that was quite a challenge.
Well, I tell you, I am many decades old, and I haven't been this excited about something in 3D for a long time, a very long time. So I really do appreciate this book. I'm going to keep it around for my grandchildren and all.
Thanks. Happy to oblige.
You're welcome. You have a great day, Dan.
Okay, you too.
Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Dan Kanin, author of Polar, a Funicular Book. Once again, more at workman.com and at motionviewers.com. You're listening to KVCR on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming up soon in Ontario, a six-act concert featuring Sonny Turner's Platters, Little Peggy, Barbara Lewis, Johnny Tilton, and Pat Boone. Also, tonight's guest, Leon Hughes from the Coasters. we know about you with the Coasters and with various other groups that I want to touch on briefly, but you actually started in entertainment acting with your parents, is that right?
Yes, I did. Wings Over Jordan Choir, traveling with them. That was a spiritual choir. From about 5 or 6 up until about 14.
Okay, wow. Now, tell us, if you would, about the Hollywood Flames. This is, of course, before you work with the Coasters. Folks outside of Watts may not know about this.
Yeah, we started that at Barrel House. They had a lot of talent shows. So we all just started singing on the street corners and then went into Barrel House and started singing there, and then we won first prize.
Oh, wow.
We started calling ourselves the Flames.
He wears a red bandana, plays a cool piano in a honky-tonk down in Mexico. He wears a purple sash and a black mustache in a honky-tonk down in Mexico, in Mexico. All of a sudden in
one... Going on to the time with the Coasters then, you were there at the very beginning of the Coasters with all of the first big hits, and one of the first big ones, Down in Mexico. I have to say, that really always had the sound of something to be used for, a TV show or a movie or something. And of course, Quentin Tarantino ended up using it in 2007 for a movie of his, Death Proof. But originally, beyond just telling a story, was there any dual purpose to this tune, like for soundtrack work?
No, it wasn't. What we were doing at the time, we were just picking stuff to do. And as we picked down in Mexico, we all started trying to dance off of it. And so we couldn't make out the dancing on it, so then we just said, hey, quit it. We're just going to go on and leave it like it is and just start singing.
Again, all leading up to the Coasters, I have to say that by the time you were playing, at your age, you could have easily been playing, say, tenor for the Basie Band, or, you know, really the pop music of the time. What got you going in the direction of R&B?
Well, we really didn't know we were going into R&B. We were just doing something. Everybody loved to sing, and we were just on the corners and getting together and going out singing, and that was it. We didn't know we were really going into rhythm and blues.
So at that point, it was just what people were doing. It wasn't even called that at that point yet.
No, wasn't.
Right.
Just that the guys just love to sing and they just love to get out and do it.
Do you remember by chance the first time you heard the term rhythm and blues? You know, you were already doing it and then somebody started calling it R&B.
I don't, because we was on the road when we first heard it.
Okay, gotcha. You were also, before the Coasters, a part of the Lamplighters. Have the Lamplighters broken up before the formation of the Coasters?
No, they haven't.
So, were you pulled away from the group then for the Coasters?
Well, yes, I were. In fact, it was the Robins who I went into the Coasters. Bobby was singing with the Robins at the time, and so they needed a tenor. So then he was a partner of mine, so they called me and said, would I come over and help him out? So I went over and started helping him out. And after I started helping him out, they just said, well, why don't you just go on and leave the Lamplighters and come over with us? So I said, okay, Bobby, because he was a real good friend of mine. So I just went with him.
And so when you joined up with him, were they still the Robins at that point then, before becoming the Coasters?
Yes, there was the Robins. And then after that, we turned into the Coasters.
Okay. You'd been singing and playing for quite some time before the Coasters. I have to ask, I've been fortunate, I think, to have interviewed Mike Stoller some years ago.
Uh-huh.
And when you first encountered Lieber and Stoller, I would love to know what struck you as different, particularly regarding the songwriting. I mean, for you, these were the guys that gave us Hound Dog with Big Mama Thornton, for example.
I didn't think too much about them at first, because when we were done, we just going on recording, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know where that they really wrote all that stuff until after we got in with them, because they had a lot of stuff there on paper. And we really didn't know if it was all them or whoever was doing the writing until after later on, then they told us that they were doing all the writing on that stuff.
So they were more like writers for Atlantic Records as opposed to writers for the
right.
Drifters and writers for the Coasters and all that.
Right.
Well, you did eventually meet them, and here's something else. Charlie Thomas described them as the guys that would be walking into the studio wearing two different colored sneakers or different colored contact lenses and stuff like that.
That was Jerry. Yeah, that was Jerry. He's a clown, that Charlie Brown.
you ended up leaving the Coasters, but was your departure from the Coasters actually because of their departure for New York?
Well, yes, some, because I had a family at the time, and the wife had started telling me that she wanted to stay home more.
Gotcha, gotcha.
So that's when I formed my own group out here.
Tell me about the Dukes then, please.
That was real cool. It was something that we all didn't know what was happening at the time. We was kind of in the dark behind that because the manager of those, he didn't ever want to show his face. We didn't know who the heck he was. Son.
Neck bones, please. Neck bones. 29 cents a pound. Neck bones. 29 cents a pound. Neck bones. 29 cents a pound. And I'm sure gonna get some more.
Were there only a couple of singles released? I know of Looking For You and The Grocery Sir. I was surprised that this one didn't chart. It seems like it would be a crowd pleaser live.
It was. It was a whole lot. That was one of the main things. What we did behind that was do a little sketch and, you know, acting with it because Bobby Nunn was kind of a clown.
This is Bobby again from the Robins and then with the Coasters, but he is also one of the guys that stayed on the West Coast when the rest of the guys went to New York.
Right. He stayed with me.
I have to say, too, the Groceries. I thought for the longest time this was either called Leg Bone or I'm sure going to get me some more. But Groceries was just always a fun, fun tune.
What, boy? Turnip greens. Turnip greens. 10 cents a bun, boy.
Now, after the Dukes, or maybe it was at the same time as the Dukes, I'm trying to sort out the timeline, you also had a couple of other groups with your brother, and then also with your brother and sister. What the, is that the Celebrities and then the Signals? Were these going on at the same time as the Dukes?
Yeah, I've come off the road, you know, like we'd be singing. And then when I come home, they say, well, we got a gig done over at this place. And I was still singing with them also, my brother and my sister and them.
Everybody was L.A.-based, basically.
Right.
Look at there.
Look at there.
So many Coasters songs, and you were there for the first bunch of them, the first big ones, Youngblood and Searchin', One Kiss Led to Another. Later on, many of the Coasters songs would justifiably be called novelty songs, some of the silly stories or goofball characters. This is after your time, things like Charlie Brown, Love Potion Number 9.
I'm on a lot of that stuff when they first recorded it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'm on a lot of that stuff when they first recorded it. And what they did, I left, and what they did when they went back into the studio, they just added over the top of my voice, or dropped my voice and put Camille's voice in there instead.
Wow, okay. As far as release, it looks like they didn't come out until much later.
Right, that was afterwards.
What were, say, some of the Coasters tunes that, after they made the move to New York, and you were no longer a part of the group, what were some of the Coasters tunes that really caught your ear? They were still getting national attention.
Yes, and I was on some of that stuff, like Shop for Clothes and Little Red Riding Hood, just a lot of those novelty stuff that we were doing. Yak Yak, when it first got started, I was on that. And then they just took my voice off and put Kanye's voice on there.
Is it still your sax?
Yes,
Okay. All right. What was the decision as far as who would provide what kind of lead? Did it just depend on who fit which voice?
That was it, what fit the voices.
So there wasn't any one. I really got confused on looking for who was the lead and who was more of a support. It was all of you guys.
Well, Carl and I, at first, like this thing down in Brazil, Carl was leading at the top and then I was leading on the bottom. It's the dual thing.
I can't get you out of my mind. Oh, I Smokey Joe's Cafe. Oh, I Smokey Joe's Cafe.
You were again out of the Coasters by the time of the British invasion, but you were still recording and performing. Did this new wave of music, as it were, change what you were doing, or at least how often you could do it musically?
It didn't ever change.
Okay. Some of the guys from the doo-wop era made a lot of adjustments when this different music was coming out. But then also folks like Sonny Turner, he said that they didn't really change. They just kept on going the way they were.
Well, you know, he made a change himself. When he started doing his stuff by himself, then he started doing a lot of performing, a lot of dancing and stuff like that. Before, he was a standstill.
He did mention that Motown actually affected the sound more than the British invasion. Later on, if you could help me sort out the groups, these are all you, but I've got listed in front of me the Coasters, 2 Plus 2, the world famous Coasters, Leon Hughes Sr., and the Fabulous Coasters, etc. There's several out here. When were these groups starting to happen? I'd like to know when you, in essence, came back to Coasters music.
That was in the 70s.
Okay, all of these different groups, and I guess it just depended on where you were performing or what lawsuit was going on at the time, or whether or not you were allowed to use the name.
Right.
You're the only surviving member of the original Coasters. One of the early Coasters hits, I don't remember if you were part of the lineup or not at that point, but Smokey Joe's Cafe.
I was on it.
That, much later on, was turned into a musical review that people can go out and see today. And I want to know if you've caught it. Have you seen Smokey Joe's Cafe?
Yes, I have. It was nice. I liked it. We saw it in Reno.
So you think they did it justice?
Yes, I do. I really do. Well, but you know what? See, we did Smokey Joe's Cafe with the Robins first.
I didn't know that was a Robins before Coasters. There's a lot of crossover there between these two early groups.
We did that before we did it with the Coasters.
Oh, my goodness.
Smokey Joe's Cafe. Take out the papers and the trash.
What are some of your favorite Coasters tunes to perform? And again, whether or not they were from the early years or the later years, just for you to have fun with.
Don't know, baby.
Surgeon, Charlie Brown, Long Came Jones.
Of course. Is that pretty much the same answer if I were to ask what gets the crowd going the most, the ones that they're most excited to hear?
Yes, indeed.
Don't talk back.
Well, getting away from the Coasters for just a second, you were born in 1929. With that, you saw the beginning of R&B, and you saw the beginning of rock and roll, and now you've also seen what these genres have become, drastically different than the early days. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, whether it's the accepted evolution or if it's, oh my God, what have they done?
No, it's accepted because everyone does what they feel. It's like an entertainment. You can go out sometime and you feel like you want it, and then the other time you feel like you don't want it. But you still have to do it that way because the people. You know, you have to satisfy the people because you want to come back to see them again. You don't want the first time to be the last time. Don't you give me no
dirty look. With the Coasters, again, there's so many upbeat, fun tunes. Do you have regular openers or closers? I'm going to call Yakety Yak if I had to call a closer.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yakety Yak is a closer.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. All right. Yakety Yak, Yakety Yak. Yakety Yak, Yakety Yak. On your website, I'd like to read this, and that is a special note from Leon. In October 1955, myself, along with my friends Carl Gardner, Billy Guy, Bobby Nunn, became the original members of the Coasters. Since then, there have been numerous performers, tribute bands, and even a few imposters who have tried to capitalize on the name and the fame that Carl, Billy, Bobby, and I started almost 65 years ago. And while Carl, Billy, and Bobby have passed on, as the last original member of the group, I take great pride in carrying on the tradition and the music that made the Coasters famous. Such a beautiful statement, Leon.
Thank you. Thank you.
When you hear other groups, let's call them imposters for just a second, but when you hear other groups performing the music of the Coasters and they're even trying to bill themselves as the Coasters, are you able to step back just a bit and go, well, they're still promoting the music, they're still keeping it alive, or is there too much of the They're calling themselves the Coasters. They're not even 35 years old yet.
What I like about it is that they're still doing it. They're still carrying it on. Like when I'm in the audience and they know that I'm there, they recognize me. And that really means a whole lot.
Absolutely. Well, these bands that you're going to be appearing with coming up in the very near future, we've got you on with Sonny, with His Platters, Johnny Tillotson, Pat Boone. This is going to be quite a lineup. Is this going to be any bit of a reunion for you?
I'm looking forward to seeing Pat and Sonny.
Well, Sonny, I just spoke to you yesterday. Pat, I'll be speaking with him in about a week and a half. I've been looking forward to this interview today. This has been really special, but I appreciate your time and I look forward to seeing you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Leon Hughes and His Coasters will be in Ontario April 2nd, along with Sonny Turner's Platters, Little Peggy, Barbara Lewis, Johnny Tillotson, and Pat Boone. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Dan Kanan, author of Polar, a particular book. Thanks also to Tori Cook, curator of Women of the New Contemporary at the Brandstetter Gallery at La Sierra University. Thanks again to Leon Hughes of the Coasters, also with the current Coasters. Thanks to Larry Hicks, assisting Leon not only with some slick guitar, but for the interview as well. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Isabella Salinas, Emmanuel Rogers, and General Manager Alfredo Cruz. Beyond the music of the Coasters, heard during that last segment, music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can find many past KVC Arts programs now as podcasts at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.